What makes good research? Having worked as a researcher for academia, nonprofits, and for-profits, I repeatedly observed something that not only struck me, but ultimately have led to my change of career path. In spite of all the countless hours that went into research, I was observing that not that much have changed. No major updates, no change of strategy. The research effort didn't necessarily transform into actual units of good. There was a big gap between research and decision making. So I started wondering, why is that? What makes good research? I decided to ask this question to a group of professionals working on methodology of science, and I heard that the good research needs to be published in peer-reviewed journal, that the study needs to have high power and big sample size, that need to be valid, capture what we set it up to capture. It need to come from non-biased source of funding and non-biased researcher. And of course, it need to present precise results. Sadly, I think that all of those qualities are extremely important. Sadly, they're also true for this study. And this one. And this one. Well, as I'm using as it is, I think that we all agree that exploring those topics is not the best allocation of our limited resources. But I think that's because basically common measure of research quality are not getting at what we as effective altruists most care about. They are not focused on increasing the impact of the research itself. So again, even though I knew the good qualities, again, I saw this gap between research and decision making. But this time, I decided to change that instead of just asking questions how to do that. So I co-founded Charity Entrepreneurship, an organization that's not only conduct research to find highest impact areas to work on, but also immediately finds people and train them to start high impact charities to implement the intervention we find to be most promising. And I'll tell you what I've learned in the process. I'll tell you about three main lessons that I apply in our research and that you can apply in your research as well. So the first lesson is to always apply conclusion to your research, to always come up to a conclusion at the end. Second lesson is to always compare alternatives with equal application of rigor. And lastly, you need to design a research to affect decision making. I'll explain what is the current problem in all of those three areas, show you an example of that, explain why it happens, and provide two solutions to address it. So first, try to reach a conclusion. Imagine that you have a crystal ball that instead of telling you the future, tells you answer to any question you have, including your research questions, and you're 100% sure that it tells the truth. Would you ask all the research questions you have to the crystal ball to avoid the effort of doing the research in the future? I think if we could, we definitely should. That's because the main goal, the purpose of conducting research, is the destination, is the answer we are getting, not the path, not the route, and the way we get there. And in my view, the ideal research is not beautifully written, properly formatted one, but the research that correctly answer and provide answer to the most important question we have. And I know that in the real world, we don't have a crystal ball, and we need to rely on strong epistemology and good research processes. But we also need to remember that the main goal is to get the answer, not to get the process. And that comes to, if we fail to reach to a conclusion, there are three major problems. The most important one, research doesn't have any impact. We might end up not utilizing the research that has been conducted, and it might not affect decisions and as a result not change anything. Secondly, we have to produce redundant research. No, when research ends with more research is needed, that indeed we need to conduct more research, very often looking at the same facts and considerations, but this time trying to draw conclusions by ourselves. And the last problem is that we might draw the wrong conclusion. So what about a situation if your audience really wants to have an answer? Maybe they're a funder who is thinking about funding a new project or a new organization. Or maybe there's a researcher who is drawn to explore this topic as well, and that might result in high impact as well. In this situation, if you as a researcher are not drawing conclusions from your own research, in a way, you're passing this responsibility to your audience. And very often, the audience might have less knowledge or less time to explore all the nuances of the whole your research, and therefore draw worse conclusion compared to conclusion that you as a researcher might draw on yourself. I think this problem became apparent to me for the first time when I was following the progress of golden rice. So golden rice is a genetically modified rice to contain vitamin A to prevent malnutrition, mostly in Southeast Asia. Copenhagen Consensus stated that implementing golden rice in agriculture was one of the biggest Bangladesh priorities. So in 2018, approval, the US Food and Drug Administration stated that the level of beta-carotene in golden rice is too low to warrant a nutrient content claim. You can only imagine what it did to public opinion about golden rice. You could see the headlines like GMO golden rice offers no nutritional benefits, says FDA. Those information was spread everywhere. For example, FDA says the golden rice is not good for your health. That's another headline that you could read. But here's the catch. It's all true. It offers no health benefits to Americans. In order to claim that food is fortified with a specific vitamin, it has to include a specific amount of based on a typical American diet. But typical Southeast Asian is 25 times the rice than typical American. Therefore, the beta-carotene is sufficient for a child that is growing in Bangladesh with a vitamin A deficiency. But it's not doesn't provide any health benefits for Americans. This kind of shows that the conclusion we might be drawing need to be relevant for the decision that is actually being made. Unfortunately, FDA adjusted their statement. They provided supplementary conclusions and helped inform the decision of Asian regulatory bodies. And as a result of that effort and many other actions, in 2019, golden rice have been approved and released in Bangladesh. The story has a very happy ending. But 2,000 children have lost their lives, and only 2,000 got irreversibly blind due to vitamin A deficiency during that time. That shows how important coming to a conclusion is if the conclusion need to be relevant for the decision that is actually being made. And of course, our conclusion need to be correct, but I think how to come to a very correct conclusion is a very tricky question. It depends on your epistemology. I will offer a few advice to suggest how to formulate good conclusion, but I won't be going into details how to make it more reliable. That has been covered quite extensively by others. So, why it happens? What stops us from drawing conclusion? First of all, we might be worried that there is not enough strong evidence and objective claims to base our conclusion on. We might introduce too much subjective judgment, too much moral calls that might not be generalizable to others. Secondly, there is too much uncertainty to propose a conclusion, and we don't want to spread incorrect information. And lastly, there's just worry that if you're going to state wrong conclusion, that might lead to reputational damage for us personally as researchers and for our organization. There are a few solutions to that. If you, in fact, don't have a conclusion, then you can first distinguish subjective models from the objective ones. Maybe you're familiar with how GiveWell does their cost-effectiveness analysis, splitting subjective moral judgment about the value of increasing impact compared to, for example, saving lives. But additionally, they have objective model when you actually look at effectiveness of specific program or intervention. And of course, at the end, if you have those models, you need to combine them to be able to make hard decisions similar to GiveWell is making it. But at least you have this very clear, transparent model that shows what's your judgment, subjective judgment, and what's objective facts. Second solution, you can state your confidence and epistemic status. And if you're conducting your research and you remain uncertain, and you cannot draw a conclusion based on evidence that you're having, you can just state that the evidence is not sufficient to draw a conclusion. But additionally, I think it's definitely worth to include what evidence is missing, why you cannot draw this conclusion, what information you need to come to the conclusion. So in the future, if somebody is researching this given topic, they can look at that specific evidence that is missing and supplement your research and come to the conclusion quicker. Last solution, you can state your direction you've updated toward to. State what's your prior opinion about giving intervention or assessment of welfare, and just state what direction you've updated to. And the last solution, if you actually do have a conclusion, you can present a list of plausible conclusions. You can assign your confidence in each of the conclusions, plausible conclusions, and then you can also provide crucial consideration of piece of evidence that is missing that will change your mind about given plausible conclusion. For that, you're just expressing what are plausible consequences of the object of your research. And what if you actually do have formulating conclusion? You're just afraid to state it. The easiest thing is to overcome anxiety. And I would hate to be responsible for directing talent and charitable dollars through another play pump type charity. However, if we slow down our conclusion or fail to present our true confidence until we are more certain, then we sacrifice all the lives that have been lost when we are building courage to do so. And we need to make the lives that are lost by slowing down our research just as salient as the one lost from being wrong. And lastly, we can build incentive structures and not punish those who fail in their charitable endeavors and those who come to incorrect conclusion. And as long as the method they used to arrive at that was correct, and the research effort shouldn't be diminished in our eyes. Second lesson I've learned was about comparing alternatives and applying equal rigor to all of them. So the first problem with comparison is that there's lots of high-quality good research out there. They might be comparing effectiveness of one intervention, that intervention that haven't been evaluated before. Or maybe it is an assessment of a life of welfare of a wild bird. Or maybe a harm that could be caused by a pandemic. The problem is that even though the research might be very high quality and can give us in-depth knowledge and understanding about a given topic, we might not be able to compare it to alternatives. So for example, what if the intervention we are evaluating right now, we know that's effective, but is it more effective than an alternative action we can be taking? Wild bird suffers enormously in nature, but it does suffer more than an insect or factory farm chicken. And pandemic might be devastating for humanity, but is it worse than a nuclear war? And I know that this point might sound like, you know, effective altruism one-on-one, very basics. But even though it's a fundamental approach in effective altruism, why we can see more comparable research? And I think not having comparison might result in taking actions that are not impactful as the alternative. So the lack of comparison is not the only problem, though. We also need to look out for a lack of equal application of rigor. Imagine that you are trying to evaluate effectiveness of intervention A. You're running very high quality RCT on that. And to evaluate effectiveness B, you are offering expected value calculation based on our best guess and our best knowledge. How much better intervention B need to be in order to compensate for lower evidence base and lower rigor? Is it even possible? You might think that we are comparing one cause or intervention in a very similar manner, but in fact, it might not be cross-applicable. We might not apply the same rigor just because, for example, we'll be looking into one intervention for a longer period of time. So we have time to discover all the flaws and all the problems with that and draw criticism. Or might we just simply, the intervention might simply have stronger evidence base, so we can really pick specific thing that is wrong about that. I think the perfect example of that is something that I observed in almost all of the charity that got started through a charity entrepreneurship incubation program. Basically, when we first suggest charity idea, they are like extremely excited and like confident. That's like the highest fuck thing. I'm going to spend my life doing that. And they start researching the idea and the confidence drops. Maybe they discover that it's harder than they expected, or the effect size wasn't as big as they hoped. However, the moment they start looking into alternative options, they realize that the alternative charity they want to start or completely different career path has flaws as well. It has even more flaws and problems than the original charity idea we suggested, and their confidence recovers. Unfortunately, most of the time, They do reflect, do apply, equal the same rigor, and the higher impact charity wins and gets started. However, imagine a situation where it's not the case. If somebody goes to pursue a completely different career because they didn't apply equal rigor, or they start a different charity that's less effective, of course, that has real consequences of the lives of beings we want to help. So always apply equal rigor. So why it happens? Why it might not happen? First of all, lack of research. If you're working in low evidence space, there is no research you can compare your object of your research to. Maybe there's not enough data that's been gathered in a very similar manner, so we cannot compare it with the same rigor. Second problem is that there is lack of systematic comparison. If we don't have a system or a research process in place that will ensure and kind of force us that at the end we'll compare all the options, our causes, our interventions, then basically it won't happen. There's also a problem with lack of preset framework and questions. If we don't have a preset process, we might end up with a situation where exploring a given area just because there's more information available there. Instead of looking at what information we need, we look at information we have and base our research on that. And the last very human reason is just curiosity. It's very tempting to follow a lead that you as a researcher have discovered. And I fully understand that. I think a lot of researchers are here decided to become researcher because of this truth-seeking drive and drive to find everything and have knowledge about all the area you're exploring. So that might be a last reason. Okay, so if you're convinced that there are benefits of systematic research, there are two simple methods to go about that. First, use spreadsheet to make good decisions. Do you remember the example of charities going up and down? That could have been prevented simply by having spreadsheet. The method isn't particularly novel, but I think it's quite underused, especially given the body of evidence from decision-making science that's suggesting its very high effectiveness. The whole process is explained in Peter Herford's EA forum blog post, and I'm just going to summarize the main steps. So first of all, if you want to, you can state your goal. For example, it could be, what charity do I want to start? You need to brainstorm many plausible interventions, many possible solutions to that. Secondly, create criteria through which you will evaluate those solutions and create custom weights for each criteria. Third step is to come up with research questions that will answer and help you to evaluate each of the idea in each of the criteria. At the end, you can look at the rating of all the ideas, you can sort it, and you'll basically see which ideas are top three plausible. And of course, it's not going to provide your ultimate answer, but at least it will narrow down the space from 1,000 things you can be doing to top three that you can explore further and kind of apply it in real life and try how it works. Okay, but we not only need to compare it to alternatives, we also need to apply equal rigor. So how to do it? Preset research process. Come up with research questions that will help you determine how well each criteria fits how each solution fits the criteria. And aim at a few things. First of all, formulate coherent epistemology and transparent strategies on how to combine different evidence. For example, how much weight do you put on cost-effectiveness analysis compared to, for example, experts' opinions or evidence from a study? And if you're looking at the study, what's important? What's more important? The results from RCT or observational study? How much more important? Secondly, have a clearly defined criteria to evaluate options with. How much weight each of the criteria carries. Next, have preset questions that will help you to rate each of the idea on each of the criteria. So for example, you might have a criteria of scale. What exactly do you mean by scale? Is it ultimate scale of the problem? Or rather, is the scale that you can affect with your actions? So having very specific questions, defining the criteria will help you to make it cross-comparable as well. And lastly, decide how many hours you're going to put into researching each of the question and apply it equally. That will basically increase the odds of your research being consistent and cross-applicable. And we know that our goal is to have the highest impact possible. That's why I need to think about designing our research process so it affects decision-making. And I know that the path is not a bit obvious especially for meta organization, a research organization, where the metrics of success are not that tangible. But we do not always have the clear and testable hypothesis about how impact will occur as a result of our actions. And that may lead to a few problems. First of all, research is not effective or less effective. If we don't have a clearly defined goal and our actions and how our action leads to that, basically it's very hard to design monitoring and evaluation system to ensure that we are on the right track. And as a result of that, we might end up not knowing that we don't have an impact. Secondly, it's very hard to find assumptions and mitigate risk if we don't have a clear path to impact. Because there's a whole range of hidden assumptions we are making that are underlying the design of our research process. And if they are left unchallenged, it can lead to one of the steps falling and making your project less effective. Next, research team. They might have not have short understanding of the project, and therefore it's harder for them to stay on track to their goal. And simply, they might feel less motivated because they don't see how these specific actions, the research paper they're writing, is connected to long-term impact. And lastly, it's very hard to communicate complex research and your initiative if you don't have a clear path to impact. And I think it's very hard to quickly convey the aims to your stakeholders, decision-making, maybe funders and organization you want to collaborate with. And it's also very hard to develop agreement among your stakeholders. Very likely, the main way your research could have an impact will be through informing other decision makers in the space, funders, direct organizations, other researchers. But if we won't directly involve decision makers in creating our agenda, then basically it won't ensure that our research will be used. So why it happens? It's hard to define the impact of meta-organizations. It's hard to measure its effectiveness with all the externalities that they have. And it's very hard to boil it down to a single goal that we can look for. And also, we just don't have control over other decision makers. We ultimately don't know if they will use our research and apply it in their actions. And lastly, it's very easy to provide this post-hoc rationalization that will be driven by general conviction of the importance of doing research. Do you remember those studies from the beginning? The one about Eiffel Tower, crocodiles, and sheep? Well, unfortunately, that happens in public health, economics, and global development. Domains I care about. There's this notion in social science that social science is like any other science. We can just create science and something eventually will come out of it and change the world. That's why the current focus is on creating good study design, when instead we should be focusing on creating good research questions. We have to have more plan, applied approach to it. If a researcher or funder is looking at those studies, they might see that the intervention might ultimately lead to impact, but they also might realize there are some missing pieces there that will basically stop you from having impact. So how to prevent that? You can build your theory of change. It's a methodology that is very commonly used in global development organizations. And I think it's essentially a comprehensive description and illustration of how and why desired change is expected to happen as a result of your action. It's very commonly used in global development and direct organizations, but I also think we can cross-apply it to research organizations. I won't go into details how to build theory of change, so I'm just going to present the core of that. First, you look at the inputs and your activities. That's kind of the program components of your organization. That might be presenting conferences, doing research, writing. Then you look at the outputs. It could be 3 research reports written or 10 research questions answers. Then you look at the intermediate outcomes of your actions. Maybe funder decided to fund different projects compared to the one that you were thinking before your research was published. And lastly, you look at the goal. And I think we shared this goal. That's the goal of reducing suffering and increasing happiness. So that's kind of the core of your theory of change. And I'm going to present you one example of that I think is one of the best illustration of a useful application of theory of change. So Happiness Lives Institute, organization that got started by Michael Flann and Claire Donaldson, built beautiful theory of change. As you can see, they consider multiple paths to have an impact. But ultimately, it can be summarized to this simple theory of change. They can conduct theoretical happiness research, for example, looking at subjective well-being as a metric, And also they do applied happiness research, evaluating charities and identifying promising interventions and projects. Then they communicate to key organizations and individuals, hoping to affect very tangible results. Ultimately, their goal is happier lives. Okay, but you not only need to build a theory of change to know how the impact is, you also need to involve stakeholders to create your effective research agenda. So you might recognize the spreadsheet is a very, very similar formula, but this time, instead of having interventions, we have specific research questions you're thinking about exploring. And instead of criteria, you have different decision makers. It might be a funder or the organization you want to collaborate with. In this situation, you can ask each of them to rate each of the research questions that you have on the scale from 0 to 10, asking how useful would it be for you to have an answer to this specific question. And when everybody fills it up, if you have all the answers, you can just simply sort it and see which research questions are going to affect their actions and their decisions the most. Okay, to summarize the main principles. Each piece of research needs to have a conclusion. If not that principle, I might have researched the exact cortisol level of cortisol in fish and how it affects with water quality. But I wouldn't be able to introduce you the Fish Welfare Initiative, organization working on improving welfare of fish, that got started this year as a result of sea research incubation program. So always try to reach to a conclusion. We also need to have a sense of how the intervention we are researching compares to other options. If not the principles, I would precisely know what's the effect of iodine supplementation. But I wouldn't compare it to folic acid and iron fortification. And I wouldn't be able to announce that Fortify Health, pursuing the latter, has recently received the second GiveWell incubation grant of $1 million and is on its way to become the GiveWell recommended charity. So always apply equal rigor. And the last key element of impactful research is the relevance for decision making in your field and decision makers that you might affect. To ensure that your research will be utilized, rooted in theory of change, and involve decision makers to create impactful research agenda. And without that approach, I'll exactly know how many cigarettes are sold in Greece, but I wouldn't be able to introduce two charities working on tobacco taxation. So always design your research to affect decision making. And as Effective Altruist motto goes, we need to not only figure out how we can use our resources to help others the most, but also turn that into action. So let's close this gap between research and decision making, and let's make research matter. Thank you.
I do want to just ask one question, which will maybe take a minute, and then we'll let everyone else go. So you mentioned that when research concludes, more research is needed, that you emphasize that it's really important for us to do that research. But one of the problems, I think, is that those research questions are just inherently less interesting to researchers than novel questions. Indeed. So how do we better incentivize that work?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think it really depends on the community you're in. If you're in a community of effective altruists, of course, I think we all agree that our main drive might be altruism and the impact we can have with our research. So I think that kind of could be the biggest incentive we have. Just remind ourselves and all the researchers that their research is not just intellectual pursuit. It's also something that really can change lives of other beings. So I think just having this in your mind will help you to choose the better research question that is not only interesting, but also it will be impactful.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So Carolina is going to be holding office hours from 3 to 3:30 in the Queen Vault if you want to ask her more questions. So thank you for this presentation, and thank you guys all for being here.